Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 48 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, the poet, novelist and librettist Ron Butlin speaks with Conor McPhee about how he came to be such a diverse writer, his differing experiences of writing in Scots and English, and the importance of music. The prize-winning novelist Ron Butlin has also been, at various times, the lyricist with a pop band, a footman, a male model, and a barnacle scraper on Thames barges. Ron has published over a dozen books, and his work has been translated into more than 10 languages. His novel The Sound of My Voice has twice been awarded a Best Foreign Novel Prize and was included in the highly prestigious Guardian's 1,000 Books You Have to Read. Ron is also a librettist and has been commissioned by many leading orchestras, chamber groups and composers, and also Scottish Opera. He's written highly successful shows for the Edinburgh Fringe, and his recent poetry collection, The Magicians of Edinburgh, has been through multiple reprints. Ron lives in Edinburgh with his wife, the writer Reggie Clare, and their dog. I spoke with him on a sunny autumn day in Perthshire. Ron, you grew up in a tiny Borders village, but ended up in Edinburgh via London and Paris. Are you a country boy or a city boy?
I think I'm very much a country boy at heart. The village I was brought up in was only about 100 people, and I lived there till I was about 11 or 12. And I can remember, even now I think, I can remember the inside of probably every house in the village. And when we did move to the local town, which had a population of a staggering 28,000, I was amazed that my parents didn't know everybody. Such was the life that I had when I started. My world, everybody knew everybody. And now that I live in Edinburgh, I live in it very much as if it were a village. And for me, it's an interconnection of various people that I know, the furthest being about a 40-minute walk away.
You have a very diverse career in the creative arts, but was there ever a time, perhaps as a young boy, when you imagined yourself in a more conventional job?
Definitely not. I never actually imagined myself ever in a job. And I think you could describe my career as a sort of series of unusual jobs that allowed me to, without much effort, earn enough money to live. And then I kind of retired about the age of 25. And I've just been kind of freelancing ever since. But the jobs that I had, I must say, were very good. I was, for example, a security guard in the Royal Scottish Academy, which meant I didn't have to do anything. I just had to be there for insurance purposes. Night shift was particularly good because then I could just, in fact, I shared it with a painter and he would go around and make copies of some paintings as sort of technique practicing, and I would just sit and write. So that was good fun. Another really good job I had that I would recommend to all would-be writers, you don't even need to get dressed for it, is I was a model at the art college, and there I had to sit for 50 minutes at a time doing absolutely nothing. That was great too, because then I could go into my imagination and then at the end of the day I could go home and perhaps try and write up what I'd been thinking about, maybe a poem or something that I was working on. So as far as the great world of adult careers goes, I think that was, yeah, that was about it. And then at about the age of 25, I just started as a full-time writer in the sense of I didn't do anything else. And we just travelled about quite a lot, living abroad, living in Edinburgh, and the only consistent part of my life was that I would be writing, and the rest of it just fell into place or failed to.
So tell us a little about your family background. Were your parents artistically inclined at all?
My father certainly wasn't artistically inclined. I never saw him read a book in his life. In fact, he a couple of times confiscated books from me. One of them, in fact, ended up in the fire, as I remember. And my mother, who is a very patient, long-suffering woman, loved singing. She was in the choir. And she also loved Scottish country dancing. But these things she could only really develop once my dad had passed on. She read quite a bit and also from time to time played the piano. I had somehow magically developed a real voracious love of reading. As you probably gather, the family life wasn't too rosy, and so it was great to be able to retreat into this imaginary world and find solace, comfort, and so on. And the other world I discovered and then relished was the world of music. And I can still remember hearing probably one of the first classical pieces I ever heard. I think it was Grieg's Piano Concerto. I was about 11 or something, and I just heard a bit of it in the radio. And I was just so excited. I thought, this is wonderful. And not only that, it makes sense, which my day-to-day life didn't. And so I think from then on, I've been exploring music and books and loving it.
On the theme of music, your very first creative adventure was as part of a pop group that actually got as far as releasing a number of records. Can you tell us a bit more about that experience?
This was in London in the late 60s when everyone was starting a band and it was full of peace and love. And it was a great place to be. There were endless parties, lots of dope, lots of girls, lots of everything. We had a wonderful time. And in the midst of it, we did, in fact, make three records. I wrote the lyrics. I didn't actually need to, well, I wasn't asked to go and play. But the band made three records, appeared on TV, and then folded. But it was really, really good fun. And I did learn a lot. I learned a lot about simply writing to, you know, to forms, to fit song patterns. The group was called Tangerine Dream, if only. We were actually called Tangerine Peel, which goes to show how near and how far we were.
Do you think that early experience writing song lyrics is what has led you to go on and become a poet?
It certainly gave me the feel for just how important within poetry we carry the music as well as the sense. In fact, sense in poetry is only one of about four or five different elements. If we think of the sound, the rhythm, the colour, you know, all the other parts that go up. Sense, in the sense of what's actually being said, is only one part of a chord that a poem makes. And writing pop songs, which were not noted for sense, was a very salutary beginning for me.
In poetry, the musical properties of the language are, as you say, very important, a significant part of the structure, if you like. Is that equally important to you in prose writing?
Yes, in a slightly different way. With prose, it certainly has to have a pulse. Otherwise, it's just dead. You know, even something like the tense, you know, whether it's present or past or future tense, for me, feels very much like the key. You know, that if it's in the present, it's in a different musical key than if it's in the past. And so it's really, really, it's good fun and also intriguing to elegantly move, if you like, to modulate from one key to the other, from the past into the future, the present. And then we get on to first person, second, third. All these have got a different feel to them as well that are, for me, as I hear them anyway, primarily musical, but then ultimately there's got to be a bit more sense in them than in a poem, because you've got to hold the reader's attention. And if you're writing a story, somewhere along the line the reader's got to be able to understand what's going on. And once you get onto theatre, it just becomes so obvious. I mean, if you have a play that's 3 hours long, it's wall-to-wall universal truth, it's just a bore.
When you're writing a play as opposed to a novel, do you have a different sense of the music of the language there?
The different rhythms, if you like, will come. If you think of a play, for example, as almost like a piece of chamber music where you've got different instrumentalists, their voice, their character, you know, what they're trying to achieve, you know, whether they're deceiving, whether they're being triumphant or successful or in danger or whatever it is. All this will change the kind of language that you're going to use. And then the other, of course, big thing is language. Is, you know, sometimes I'll write in Scots, and that, again, is a fresh input. I think that with Scots, we have very much the oral tradition, and that oral tradition works so well in poetry. You couldn't, very difficult to imagine a Scots poem that wouldn't want to be read aloud whether it's an English poem. Yes, sometimes they work just on the page.
Do you feel more of a native in one of those languages, Scots or English?
When I was a child, I didn't realise that I spoke Scots. I was in the village, and when we went to school, it was the first time I'd come up against educational authority. And in those days, you got hit over the head if you spoke Scots in the school. You had to speak proper English. That's what they were drumming into us. And in fact, I remember one teacher, it was very shocking now, and it wouldn't happen nowadays. Attitudes have completely changed. When I spoke just the way that I spoke in the playground, in the class, she just said, "Oh, that is gutter talk." Writing in Scots didn't come consciously to me. When I was about 18 or 19, I'd been writing in English all the time. And the poems became smaller and smaller and denser and more incomprehensible, enigmatic, gnomic, and in fact downright just clotted. And to my surprise, one day, I just suddenly started writing in Scots. I immediately found myself writing with humour, writing much more about feelings. It just wasn't coming from the head. It was coming from somewhere far, far deeper. And I wrote exclusively in Scots for several years. And then, just as mysteriously, I began to write in English again. It was as if the Scots had opened up part of me that the English couldn't reach. But having opened up, it then became accessible to the English. And it was a purely subconscious thing. And I suspect it was to do with my age, that by the time you're about 18, 19, you're beginning to wonder really who you are, what the world's like and where you're going. And you're no longer taking the past for granted. And I'm sure that that move into Scots was a kind of linguistic way in which that happened.
I'd like to pick up on what you said about the oral tradition being very important still in Scotland, but I wonder if that gives your role as the Macar of Edinburgh a particular savour, I suppose. You know, the fact that there is a public role for poetry in Scotland, even in schools with Burns competitions and so on, that perhaps doesn't exist in other parts of the UK now.
I think that's probably quite right. I remember the first time I went down to London to do a reading, I was amazed at the people I was reading with. They got up behind a lectern and they just sort of seemed to talk to themselves, except loud enough for the audience to hear. They just read the poems. There was no real attempt given to communicate with the audience hugely or to dramatise or to express. They were still private poems that were being overheard by the audience. And I was really, really surprised, because what I knew so far from the elder writers, my models that I'd seen in Scotland, was this oral tradition that we just thought, well, that was the way poetry did. And there were also some of the Liverpool poets, of course, Roger McGough, Brian Patton, and they also had seemed to have this kind of oral tradition as well. So it's not just Scotland. But it certainly did seem to be more pronounced there. And being Macar, it is, as you said, a public office. And it would seem very odd if I was commissioned, say, to write a poem, as I was earlier this year, to celebrate painter Elizabeth Blackadder, if I just handed her over the poem, like a sort of cup or something, and it wasn't recited in front of the audience and at the celebration.
You were mentioning music just now, and you started out writing pop songs, but you've gone on in later life to write opera libretti. I'm wondering if that's very different from writing poetry or prose fiction. Does it have very different constraints?
The big difference is that someone's asked you to do it. You're commissioned to write an opera. Very few people, I think, would sit down and say, right, I'm going to write a 20th century ring cycle and just sit down in their back room and do it. Because the chances of it being performed, I'm afraid, are pretty slim. So most of these things have arisen out, well, in fact, they've all risen out of a commission. And the commission is quite clear how long it's going to be, what it's going to be about. That's usually come from myself in conjunction with in discussion with the composer, of course. And the number of characters, who they are, the voices, the voice ranges that we're considering, the instrumentation, what size the orchestra or chamber group is. So there are all these constraints, but like any constraints, you can then turn them on their head and they become a kind of freedom. So the drama can then find itself within that, and it's actually very liberating.
What's the process like working with a composer? Do you work fairly independently, or is there much interplay between you?
Well, so far I've worked with quite a few composers. Well, two in particular, Kenny Dempster, who's one of a well-known Scottish composer, and Lyle Cresswell, originally from New Zealand, who is a very well-respected Scottish composer now as well. And with Lyle, for example, I've done three operas, two short and one longer, for Scottish opera. And it's always been the same with whatever composer I'm working with. It is that I would create the libretto first of all, or a working version of the libretto, because then the composer will be able to know what the dramatic flow of it is, for example, you know, the climaxes, etc., etc. And when I hand it over, let's say I hand it over to Lyle, he will then look at it, we'll discuss it, he will make a start on it, and then during the course of writing it, he will come back to me again and again with various things, saying this line needs to be in a certain rhythm, not the rhythm that it's in. God, I remember one email I got from him once. He said, can I have two lines of deep despair and a rollicking drunken song, if possible, by the end of the week? So, you know, sometimes you've got to work, because you're also working to a timetable. To put an opera on, you know, the libretto's got to be started quite early on. So there is a very long process, of which I am at the beginning and become less and less involved as it goes on. Only in the final stages, I might then be asked, are we bringing out the right aspect here? Or, you know, is this character reacting in the way that you imagine that he should do? Are we missing something? And then I would maybe put in my tuppence worth just at the end. But by and large, my big input is at the beginning.
Have you ever been tempted to try writing music yourself?
I think we'll just say no. No, I know my place.
You've said elsewhere that you began as a poet, but because so few people buy poetry, you had to diversify in order to survive. Looking back now, do you regret that? Do you wish you'd been able to make a living purely from poetry?
I've enjoyed the opportunity to diversify. I've enjoyed the chance to write novels, to broaden my craft, if you like, in different media, you know, fiction, plays, journalism, which I really enjoyed doing. I learned a lot from journalism. You know, I did think pieces, as they're called. You know, they might be social comment, they might be political, they might be about the arts, whatever. And I would be told they want 800 words by next Monday, or 1500 or whatever, and they didn't want 1400. They didn't want 1600. I had to give them 1500, exactly what they asked for. And that was such a discipline. And it also had to be readable, you know, because most people, when they look at papers, are skimming through to find something of interest. So you have to capture their interest from the beginning and then hold it. And if I just stayed writing poetry, I would never have been exposed to this. And so, yeah, no, I think there's no regret whatever.
Well, speaking of other forms, when I read your first novel, The Sound of My Voice, I was struck by the fact that it was written in the second person. So the protagonist, Maurice Magellan, is addressed throughout the book as you. You did this, you did that. That's quite unusual in a novel. What was it that made you choose to write it in that way?
Well, I suppose I didn't choose to do it. I didn't even choose to write the novel. I thought it was a short story. I start with a few words, and the few words that came to me were in the second person. And after, you know, a couple of days of doing the short story, I thought, I wonder what this looks like in the first person. Well, it kind of looked all right. But it didn't have the same energy. It didn't have the same feel for me. And so I just kept it in the second person. I had no idea why. And I just let it go on and on and on. I don't write novels in sequential scenes or anything like that. I tend to write for a few days, one bit, and then once I've run out of steam on that, I'll put it aside. And there's usually another bit from completely different part of the novel, as it will turn out eventually, bobs up, and then I'll start doing that. And I end up with 30, 40 bits of a few pages length each. And it's a bit like a jigsaw. except there isn't any picture that you're aiming to fill out. You know, there's no model that I'm trying to piece them together to portray. And then I just try and put these pieces together and see how they could possibly fit. And gradually a novel begins to emerge from that. It's a bit of a roundabout way of doing it, but I seem to be stuck with it.
Although it's uncommon for novelists to use second person, it's actually reasonably common for poets. And quite often when a poet writes a poem addressed to you, they're actually talking to themselves. Do you think that was the case with the novel? Were you talking to yourself?
The character was talking to himself. But if you like, one part of him was doing the talking, the other part wasn't doing any listening. And I only realised the dynamic of what was going on there, the internal dynamic, only to very much towards the end of the novel. And I thought, oh, goodness me, that's what it's all about. Because I really hadn't much idea. And it's something that just did come quite naturally, despite the fact I'm not an alcoholic. I like wine, I like beer. But no way am I like that. And I really use the alcohol as a kind of metaphor for someone in their early 30s who were quite simply losing the place in their life and were wondering where on earth they were going and where, how it was all going to end up. And I believe that there is this voice inside of all of us, we each have one of our own, that is our uniqueness, our imagination, our God, our conscience, call it what you like. And it is possibly, I think, unless we're very lucky in love, it's the only thing in the universe that's actually on our side, totally. And the problem is that we hardly ever listen to it. It babbles away, it tells us good advice and all the comfort and everything in dreams, and it tells us it all the time, but most of the time we don't listen. Morris didn't listen either, but the voice kept telling, and in that telling was the story, the narrative of the novel, and then gradually he becomes more aware of it and things begin to change.
I've sometimes thought that one of the privileges of being a writer is that that voice gets a chance to speak. You know, it's sort of subtly speaking through your creativity, and sometimes you'll look back 6 months on at something you've written and think, my gosh, there it is. It was telling me this all that time ago, and it's taken me all this time to realise.
I utterly agree, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. We have this experience and we say, right, from now on I'm going to listen to that voice. I'm going to pay attention to my dreams. I'm going to do this and that. And then, do we?
As artists and as people, we all have good days and bad days. So what does a good day look like to you?
Well, it can be different kinds of good days. But certainly getting up reasonably early and then work. So normally I'd work probably from about, I don't know, 9 till about 1:30, 2, something like that. You know, there, you know, I'm dealing with the furnace of my being and all that in writing and so on. And then lunch, man, lunch is great. I so look forward to it. Because what I do is I sit and watch telly for 30 minutes. And I've seen a 30 minutes of so many films. You know, just sort of bits out the middle, bits out the end. And I've never seen any of these films all the way through. And sometimes months later, this is how that film began. And so I have this period where it just completely wipes my brain clear. And then later on in the afternoon, I'll, you know, do things, maybe go shopping, whatever. I might go for a dog walk with Reggie or whatever. And dinner is like the centre point of our life. Something that we've done now, must be a good 15, 16 years, is that while Reggie cooks, I read to her. And we've now got through well in excess of 100 books, you know, including several full-length Dickens and just all kinds of stuff. We just finished Ray Bradbury's short stories, the collective, that was a real discovery. P.G. Woodhouse was another very recent one that went down very well. So I will sit having a glass of wine, a few olives and pretzels, and Reg will be cooking, and then we have the dinner. And then afterwards I'll probably go and read or whatever, and Reg will go up and work, which I just couldn't imagine doing after this. Another very nice end to the evening would be that we would go out and meet friends, you know, either at a restaurant or at their house. Occasionally, but once every 2 months, I meet friends of mine who are musicians, and we have what's called a little Schubertiad. And there they bring their instruments. There's a cellist from the Edinburgh Quartet, there's a classical guitarist, another violinist, and me, sometimes Reggie. And then we would have a huge Chinese carry out, lots of wine, and then they will play. and Reggie and I will read just what we're currently working on, and then we might chat about it, but not too much. It's more just a case of trying things out and seeing what we go. But it's a wonderful experience.
So do you think you'll ever retire?
No. I couldn't imagine. I wouldn't want to not work. It's just as natural as breathing. And I sometimes say this to students. I say, you know, you can't stop yourself breathing. And similarly, dreams are a great example. You can't stop your imagination from telling you how it is.
Ron Butlin, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That was Ron Butlin in conversation with Kona McPhee. You can find out more about Ron on his website at www.ronbutlin.co.uk. And that concludes episode 48, which was recorded and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 49, the non-fiction writer Annette Kobach considers the lessons that other art forms might provide to the practicing writer, including suggestions from her own experience as a writer and painter. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.